table are Senator Donnelly, Senator Lehman, Senator Wilkins, Senator Olson, Senator Hoffman, Osterman, Green, and Kelly. Today we have a number of bills up. One of the bills that we were going to have up is It was the railroad bill, which I'm moving till tonight. I don't remember what the number was, but it's on the railroad.
123.
SB 123, which we'll be hearing tonight. And we have before us Senate Bill 37, Senate Bill 143, and Senate Bill 104, which is the state aid to volunteers. And we will start off with Senate Bill 37, which is the bill that provides a state action doctrine for physicians. Essentially, what it does is it creates in law a structure by which physicians can negotiate with insurance companies collectively without violating antitrust laws if they have the oversight of a state agency, and that essentially what state action doctrine does is it creates the oversight of these negotiations by a state agency. In this case, we've used the Department of Law. This came from a court case back in 1943, a Supreme Court decision that accepted the fact that the antitrust provisions weren't always going to work in every situation, and in those situations where it probably wasn't appropriate to apply strict laws apply strict antitrust provisions, that there should be a state oversight. So what we're creating here is the ability of physicians to come together and negotiate with insurance companies on a voluntary basis without getting a letter or a suit from the FTC. Chris, you want to go ahead and present the finer details of the bill?
My name is Chris Knopf, Staff Senator Pete Kelly, Fairbanks. More of the technical aspects of the bill, I guess I can explain, is if a healthcare provider and a group of physicians decide to negotiate, first of all, in per geographic service area in the state, if there's more than 40 physicians in an area, only 30% of them can negotiate. But if there's less than 40, then 100% can negotiate. So in the more urban areas, such as Anchorage, you're only going to have about 30% of the market negotiated with a bigger insurance company. What we've done with the bill since the last version, and we do have a blank CS in front of you. I don't know if you want to adopt that.
Not right at this moment.
Okay. Basically, what we've done is we've excluded the self-insured from the bill, such as the state, many of the unions, interests for that. We have also changed some of the bill's work around in the bill where it says when a physician can negotiate, they can only negotiate. When a physician can negotiate with a healthcare provider and there is an authorized third party they must go through, those negotiations become confidential with a third-party representative rather than having a public process and hearing. Mr. Chairman,
you're saying that a physician is negotiating with a health care provider. Isn't a physician a health care provider?
Health care. Yes, you're right. That's true. Insurance company. Okay. So now that everyone's confused completely, I guess what we're looking at is why this is needed. It's needed because we don't have a very competitive group of large insurance companies in the state. There's only approximately four or five large insurance companies that carry a substantial portion of the market. And what we're trying to do is open the doors for smaller insurance companies to come in and negotiate with these physicians.
Well, the problem that you have is that in the past few years, the number of insurance companies in the United States has gone from, of the majors, has gone from about 18 to 6, and as they continue to buy each other up and merge, they gain more and more market power. The corresponding side of the coin with the physicians is that the physicians have had forever, but they have the restraints of the antitrust laws working against them. So if they came together to discuss with a fellow colleague something that might be going on with their negotiations with an insurance company, the FTC could literally shut them down and fine them. We had a case like that happen to Fairbanks, where they attempted to come together and negotiate, and the FTC wrote them a very threatening letter. And I don't remember exactly. Was there a fine attached to that incident in Fairbanks?
It's just a written statement from the FTC.
So essentially, it allows them to come together, again, as I said, on a voluntary basis, and negotiate with these insurance companies about terms and conditions, and they won't be threatened with legal action because of it. Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. One of the questions I have, and I'm not sure if it's for Mr. Noss or it's for the bill sponsor, is that I noticed that the statement was made that the self-insured were excluded. And I can understand that if you have a large body that has a number of physicians that are working for them, they can be excluded. But what about the solo practitioner that's sitting out there in North Pole, or the fellow down there in Kenai, or the guy in Talkeaton, or the guy out in Nome that's self-insured? Why is he being excluded, is my question.
Being excluded in that he wouldn't be able to take advantage of the bill. He's being excluded from the provisions of the bill. In other words, if the person who's self-insured wanted to negotiate with, there is no guy off in Kenai, I guess is the point. There are the municipalities that are self-insured and the state of Alaska that's self-insured and some of the unions that are self-insured. You don't have small plans. You have the physician who's kind of out there on his own, but you don't have a corresponding entity that he has to deal with that is on their own. The self-insureds are a group.
Sure, I guess my real question is, can you define self-insurance for me? I'm assuming you're talking about self-insured, meaning covering malpractice and those kind of...
No.
I'm confused.
It's not the self-insured doctors. It is the state of Alaska that insures itself. It is the Teamsters Union that insures itself. I thought that's what you were saying. I didn't explain it well enough. Senator Green, did you have a comment on that?
No, I was just going to make that point. It has to do with groups of people who have chosen to be self-insured rather than have a third-party person take over the insurance rather than deal directly with an insurance company outside their organization.
Got some testimony on the bill. I'm going to go to Mr. Sniffen, Department of Law. Okay, go ahead and testify if you would. Mr. Sniffen? Just a moment, Mr. Sniffen. Could you maybe try to get a little closer to the microphone? That might help.
Let me see if I can crank the volume up here.
All right, you're better. Yes, it is.
I'm the Deputy Director for Division of Retirement Benefits, and I'm just here to see if you have any questions regarding our fiscal note.
Okay. March 15th?
I don't have a March 15th one.
Okay.
Sorry, Wilson, did you say March 14th or 15th?
14th and 15th. Okay. Okay.
All right.
Last day, 15th. Is that fiscal note we should?
Yes.
Is that the one you?
Yes.
It seems like, when you, in my mind, when you think of this bill, you think of in a way, increased competition ought to drive down costs. But this bill seems to indicate that it just goes the other way, that we're going to have the chance of driving up by almost $9 million the state plan. So I'd like to understand, how does that do that in the state plan? And I would expect that if it does it on the state plan, it would probably do it on other plans. Maybe if we could work through this, because I'm in favor of this bill because it seems like it would drive down costs, but you suggest it drives it up. So what's the mechanism?
They have implemented this bill in other locations. They haven't all been under active participation, but what we are doing here is granting providers the opportunity to band together and negotiate. They're not going to negotiate their benefits or their reimbursement down, they're going to try to negotiate it up. And that's why they believe, and you know, the studies that have come out, is that this would actually increase what the consumer.
Ms. Parker, you have on here 5 to 13% increase. Throughout the course of this bill and last year as well, we heard many people testifying that this would drive costs up. The negotiation is completely voluntary. If the insurance company wants to say, we simply don't want to negotiate with you, they don't have to. If you also notice that the provisions of the bill state that the physicians cannot act in a retaliatory manner, they can't boycott. And I guess I'm just really confused as to saying that a few doctors can get together with an insurance company and ask to negotiate. Now, the way things are now, they couldn't even get to that point. They couldn't even ask to negotiate because that in itself would be a violation of antitrust laws. All we're doing is saying we want the physicians to be able to act in such a manner that they can at least come to a group to decide whether they want to negotiate in the first place without violating the law, which strict interpretation of the antitrust laws would provide for. And then the insurance company could say, nah, we don't want to. I don't see 5 to 13%. I've heard 25%. You know, the sky is falling. How is that going to happen?
It's really hard to tell at this point in time what's going to happen because it hasn't occurred. You know, there's no other group that we can go to, another state we can go to that said this is what will happen when you implement this. They've just done some studies based upon some federal legislation that was similar. This is what they believe will happen. No one will know until...
There were some studies on that, and there were also studies that said the methodology on the study that you're referring to was completely out of whack, and it sounds to me, and Ms. Parker, I certainly don't mean to criticize what you've said, because I know these aren't the numbers that you've come up with necessarily. I mean, I'm not holding you accountable for these exact numbers in here, but they're the numbers I've been hearing from a number of organizations and testifiers, and I think it's a number that's just flat been pulled out of the air. Okay, well, Ms. Parker, I don't want to put you on the spot. You're to answer questions on the technical aspects of the bill, and that's fine. And if the committee has any questions of those, I'd go ahead and entertain those at this time. Thank you. And if we may call on you again. But I think that it brings up a pretty good point. How is something that's completely voluntary going to drive costs up in the state? I don't think so. Because, as I said, the physicians can't even come together. I mean, if you have a few doctors working in the same clinic, they can be down the hall from each other. The insurance companies can. I'm not saying this always happens to them, but the insurance companies can come to them and say, here's our proposal, take it or leave it. The doctor can't go over to his other colleague and begin to discuss those terms with that colleague without... being in danger of getting a letter from the FTC saying knock it off. If they were to come together and discuss the terms of the contract and then approach the insurance company as a group without this bill, they would be in violation of the antitrust laws, and they would be in trouble, and they could suffer fines and penalties. All this does is say, let's create a state action doctrine, provide some oversight so that we don't have doctors acting in a manner that would be counter to the best interests of the state, but allow them to come together so that they have some market power in dealing with these corporations that are getting larger and larger and more powerful, and there is not a corresponding mechanism to allow doctors to become more powerful so that there's some kind of equality and equity in the bargaining position. That's all this bill does. It is not a sky-is-falling bill, as has been presented in many other committees and conversations that we've had over this bill. Senator Osterman?
Hi, Bill. Going to testify today.
This guy here, this guy's not online, and I don't see him. No, apparently not. Any other questions or comments? Mr. Smithson testified, Ms. Parker testified. If there are no other questions from the committee, I'm going to hold this bill over. I want to look at a few issues that have been brought up, but I'm not comfortable in speaking of them because I don't think I could accurately explain them. So we'll probably come back tonight and try to move the bill at that time. Have a brief at ease. We have before us Senate Bill number 143, which is the natural resources right-of-way. It's a long title. I'll let you describe the Senate.
Wow, it's longer than the bill.
Senator Torgerson or staff thereof, would you like to present the bill? Okay, come on up, everyone.
Chairman John Ferguson from the Kenai Peninsula with me is Darwin Peterson of my staff. Senate Bill 143, short title, Right-of-Way Leasing Act Application Costs. The current statute does not let us collect for services that we provide for pipelines when an application has not been filed. After an application is filed and the costs that are determined to be reimbursable are paid by the processors or the applicant for that for the lease. What Senate Bill 143 stipulates that for gas lines only, that we can start collecting the costs that are determined to be reimbursable on pre-applications or the work that is happening before the application is actually put in. And Mr. Chairman, I know that this committee struggled with or did work on the supplemental budget where we had a $4 million request and also another request for $10 million or thereabouts for application costs next year. So this bill is basically saying that we'll be able to collect that money, maybe not all of it, but whatever the producers or the applicants want to pay for, whatever studies they want to pay for, they can come in with their checkbook and the department can enter into a memorandum of understanding or an MOA with them to start the reimbursement process immediately instead of waiting until there's an actual application filed.
Senator Torgerson, your son setting this bill essentially. What's the purpose for that?
Mr. Chairman, I do have a sunset clause in here from 2003. The thought process behind that was that basically there should be an application. If you listen to the producers, some think there may be an application by the end of this year. Others think it may be the beginning of next year. But in any event, once the application comes in, then we go under existing law. So I'm just saying that this particular bill, so it's not wide open for the administration to go out and make deals all the time, that we would sunset it in 2003. So it should be ample enough time. But again, a very simple fix if we don't have an application in and there's still work that needs to be done, then we extend the sunset date to a couple more years.
Senator Torgerson, we were doing the capital budget overviews about 2 weeks ago, and there was a portion in there. It was $10 million. You just briefly mentioned that. Does this cover that? I mean, do you think it adequately covers that, or have you delved into that?
Mr. Chairman, I did look through the $10 million. There are some expenses that that will probably be determined not to be reimbursable. And the fiscal note, I don't agree with the fiscal note. They're basically saying only $4 million of the $10 million would be reimbursable. I personally think it's higher than that. But in any event, it doesn't cover it all, such as, you know, maybe computers or other things that we have to do to bring levels up up to a certain performance levels. But in any event, it goes a long ways toward paying for those costs.
Questions from the committee? Senator Green?
I know this would never happen. However, could the department arbitrarily charge someone, saying, we think you're going to apply for this? Is there any safeguard that there wouldn't be a too zealous implementation of this? And it's probably spelled out in here. I just don't know.
We have statutes. It's not spelled out in here, but we do have other statutes that determine what is reasonable costs.
Yes, that's correct, Mr. Chairman. Most of this will be covered under an agreement, so that, and we currently have regulations and statutes that cover what reimbursable expenses are. Some of this, for example, this $3.9 million that they're talking about in this fiscal note, if they put an application in, would be reimbursable to us when they put the application in. Just saying, pay it now, not wait until later on. It's a way to keep our fiscal note down and our expenses down, and also a way to make the producers or the builders of the line serious about their line enough that they're going to come in and put money down for the studies that they want to have done, so we're not out doing things that they may or may not want.
Senator Green?
So the applicant triggers this process.
Yes.
Okay, that's probably the better way to say it. Thank you.
But they're actually paying fees before they have their permit, whereas in the past you're saying those fees would be paid after they get the permit?
That's correct, Mr. Chairman. The ones that are reimbursable could be backed up to the beginning, and then they'll be reimbursed at some time in the future. This just puts this into place now instead of waiting for a reimbursement.
Other questions from the committee?
Mr. Chairman, I was just to Senator Green's question. The bill says that there can't be any charges until there's an actual agreement signed. So to your fear that they might just send them a bill, there has to be the agreement worked out first, and then after that, it would clearly show the scope of the work, hopefully the amount of the work, and then it'd be signed by all parties. So that theoretically, there would be an argument a little later on about I did this and that I don't have to pay it.
Okay, thank you.
Any other questions from the committee? Are there amendments? Can I get a motion?
Public testimony?
No.
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Donnelly?
Senate Bill 143 from committee with individual recommendations and the accompanying fiscal.
No.
Hearing none, Senate Bill 143 is moved from committee with individual recommendations and accompanying fiscal notes. Senator Ferguson?
Yes.
We have another bill of yours up.
Hi.
You've got that moved from the committee, correct? We finished that motion and everything. Next up, we have Senate Bill 104, which has to do with state aid for volunteer services. Also, Senator Torgerson's bill. I'd like to present the bill, Senator Torgerson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senate Bill 104, quite simply, pays volunteer fire departments and volunteer EMS services $10 per capita for the area that they serve. This is a big issue for a couple of my volunteer areas, such as Cooper Landing, that basically has a service area that probably is ranges 60 miles from one quarter to the other, with most of that is highway-type accidents and things of that nature that there are not even people that live within that area, so they're required to go out and, of course, respond to any type of injury, accident. But that volunteer fire department also is out having cookie sales and pancake feeds to buy gas and do other things, and this is an attempt to try to give them a little bit of money, not just them, but all the purely volunteer fire departments and purely volunteer EMSs to help offset some of their operating expenses.
Questions? This is a redistribution of money. This isn't new money, is it?
I believe it's new money.
The 863 is all new money going to EMS accounts.
General fund.
Yep, general fund.
General fund. Huh?
Yep. Senator Wilkin?
Senator Ferguson, are there any volunteer fire departments or EMS services that are greater than 2,500?
I'm not sure.
The answer is yes.
Senator Olson?
The answer is yes.
Oh, Chugach.
Yeah. Chugach and Eagle River both have volunteer fire departments.
Mr. Donnelly, did you have a question?
I just wondered, the 2,500 limit.
Apparently we have some experts here that can answer those questions.
Okay.
I'm not sure.
Senator Torgerson, Senator Donnelly had a question.
I just wonder what the thinking behind the 2,500 limit was.
It's current law, Senator Donnelly.
But the current law was whether they were organized or unorganized.
Well, but the 2,500 is in, that's the trigger for unorganized. This opens it up for organized or unorganized.
Any other questions of the sponsor? We have Matt Anderson to testify. Mr. Anderson, could you come up and say your testimony, please?
Good morning. For the record, my name is Matt Anderson. I'm the unit manager for the Emergency Medical Services Unit within the Department of Health and Social Services. I'll make my remarks brief and confine them to the Emergency Medical Services System. As you may know, over the past decade or so, the amount of financial resources available to small rural EMS services, most of which are volunteer, has decreased dramatically. This has been a large factor in services closing their doors, decreasing the scope of care they're able to provide, decreasing their operational hours. In 2001, we're seeing some dynamics which include an increase in the cost of operations, gas, insurance, all those things that are required to keep an ambulance service operational. We're also seeing that the run volume has increased. The number of responses that these agencies need to make have gone up. We're also seeing that much of the capital equipment that these services own are nearing the end of their useful lives. And lastly, that there are some changes in communications technologies and in standards of care which are increasing the cost of some of these services as well. We have been very active through our regionally enough council system looking at the unmet needs in rural emergency medical services, and have heard stories of exhaust filling the patient compartment, requiring the emergency medical personnel to use the medical oxygen and back. We've heard stories of electrical systems failing, both in response and while transporting patients. We've heard of brakes failing or needing repair, taking rigs out of service. I can't help but think those types of dynamics really exacerbate the problem that all of us are seeing with recruitment and retention of volunteers. The scarce resources, as I said, are being used for operational means, and what winds up happening is that things like training and other things that are really essential to the safe and efficient operation of an emergency medical service are being necessarily diminished. We're supportive of efforts to increase the amount of financial resources available to rural emergency medical services, and believe that particularly predictable funding that results in services being able to plan for future purchases and maintenance are really laudable. We think that this kind of system is an excellent adjunct to the well-developed emergency medical services regional system that we have today. And with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions, one of which came up earlier with the chair's permission. There are a number of services that we certify as emergency medical services that operate in communities greater than 2,500. Anchorage, Kenai, Sitka, Ketchikan, those are all good examples of such services.
Question, Senator Wilkin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. As I look at this list, I don't know how extensive the information is behind it, but let me just ask, if I picked just someone out, let's take Esther, Volunteer Fire Department. We serve almost 1,900 people in my district. Is there a tab somewhere that tells us what the local borough or the local people support each of these volunteer fire departments, to what extent?
We don't have that information in the Department of Health and Social Services. We look at their operational readiness and their service capabilities, and not their finances.
Who do you think would know that in state government?
I think community and economic development may, but I can certainly look into that.
No, that's fine. I'll ask that. Thank you.
Ms. Jackson, did you...
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Mary Jackson. I'm staff to Senator Ferguson. Through the chair, Senator Wilkin, the representative from the Department of Human, can probably answer some of those questions as well. And I'm here as well, Mr. Chairman.
Now, you were pointing to someone back there that would have those answers, but there, you're not signed up, are you? I don't have your name on a piece of paper.
If there's no more questions, I'll bow gracefully.
Thank you, Matt.
For the record, I'm Bill Ralston, an employee of the Department of Community and Economic Development. Regarding Senator Wilkins' question, that information will be readily available through the borough's budget and year-end financial audit. They break out that information by service area.
Senator Wilkins?
Do we, as the state, collect that information? Could I tell how much ADAC provides in local support as compared to ESSER?
Senator Wilkin, no, you could not. Currently, ADAC is an unincorporated community. There's no nonprofit. They're currently petitioning to form a second-class city.
I use that as an example. My question is, do we track as state government the amount of local participation that is matched with the state funding in unorganized Alaska to support their fire department?
Senator Wilkins, currently under the state revenue sharing program, the only accounting as far as volunteer fire departments in the unorganized borough is reporting on the revenue sharing funds. Well, many of them do report their entire budget, but we only require that they report on the fire department on the revenue sharing fund.
To your knowledge, is there some local participation in all volunteer fire departments?
Senator Wilkins, based on the cutbacks in revenue sharing over the years, and if you'll note, currently, every year it seems like the number of volunteer fire departments is diminishing, corresponding to the amount of funding. Currently, this year we funded 21 volunteer fire departments. 5 received over $500, 4 received under $100, and 12 received between $100 and $500. So all of them contribute local money, whether it's through bake sales or whatever they need to do, raffles, to try to support their volunteer fire departments.
Senator Wilkin?
So the existing program under existing law that's referred to here only serves 21 fire departments in the state?
That's how many funded in FY01.
Okay, thank you.
Any other questions? Go ahead and hold this bill. Probably till tonight. Any other business to come before the committee? We have another evening meeting, and see you then. With that, we are adjourned.